This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 321 was recorded on April 28th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by FarmTogether.com, where you can hedge against inflation and protect your portfolio by investing in U.S. farmland, now available to all accredited investors. And by Composer, making institutional-grade quantitative algorithmic trading and backtesting available to the masses. With escalating geopolitical conflict around the globe, commodities come into focus for their critical role in the global economy. So we're bringing back Saxo Bank's Commodities Desk Chief, Ola Hansen, as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss what both inflation and the escalating war situation mean for commodities, and I think you'll really enjoy this interview. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Technical Crossroads.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, you know what? Last week's episode, I was contemplating the idea that the market could be due for a little bit of a rally from an oversold correction. And well, that lasted a whole 5-10 minutes. And before the show was even released, the sell-off began. We basically saw the S&P, you know, wipe out close to 300-400 S&P points in a week, retesting those March lows. What's your take on what just happened here?
Well, Patrick, I have to say I'm baffled by the sentiment I perceive from everybody, including yourself. You know, you were talking about, boy, we're coming off that oversold condition. A lot of other people are talking about the extreme volatility that we've seen in equity markets. Look, there's been no significant vol yet. And what do you mean oversold condition? The S&P is still way above 3,000, and I can't think of a good reason why. So I guess I just see this as differently. World War III is a bigger deal than a global pandemic. We saw a pretty significant sell-off in March of 2020. We got the taper. We've got World War III, Fed supposedly normalizing its balance sheet. You know, what does it take to bring on a good old-fashioned cyclical bear market? I think there's plenty of room for more downside. I don't see why everybody is talking about, you know, is it time to buy the dip yet? I don't get it. So, you know, and I think one of the biggest things that's going on here is people are starting to ask the question of, you know, is it possible that we could be headed toward a recession? Well, look, let's do recessions 101. Normal economic condition works like this. The central banks, such as the Federal Reserve, are working as hard as they possibly can to use both conventional and non-conventional monetary policy tools to prevent a recession at all costs. Now, we have in this environment a situation where, as far as I can tell, the Fed is trying to consciously and intentionally engineer a recession because it's the only way to fight inflation. It's much easier to cause bad things to happen intentionally as opposed to preventing bad things from happening. Anyone who's ever carried a sledgehammer into a China shop can attest to that. So I don't understand why everybody is so optimistic here, but I think if the Fed wants to bring on a recession, they can, they likely will, and it seems to me that that's what's going on here. Now, Ola Hansen disagrees with it. He thinks the recession risk is extremely low. We'll get to that in today's feature interview.
All right. Well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because if there's one macro market that is moving with some serious velocity, it's that U.S. dollar. And it's now really almost against every cross currency. Does this have more to go? I mean, we're going back to those almost decade highs.
I think we're going to break the decade highs and go higher than that. The thing is, we've moved very quickly, quite a bit here, and so obviously some kind of technical pullback is entirely to be expected. I have no idea when that might or might not come, but I think that we're going to get pretty soon here back up to 104, which whatever the 104 spot something, whatever the peak was from a few years ago. I would imagine that we will get some resistance at that level, maybe a little bit of consolidation. But eventually, I think we'll break higher than that. Now, to be clear, my long-term prediction is that the outcome of this fourth turning cycle at the end of World War III is very likely to be a loss of U.S. dollar hegemony and the replacement of the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency. But that's still, you know, 6, 7, 8 years off. In the meantime, I think this war cycle is entirely dollar bullish. And with the caveat of obviously expecting a few pullbacks along the way, I expect the dollar to continue to march much higher.
So, Eric, more or less, the last month, almost 2 months, has just been oil trading in an incredibly wide range, swinging from the 90s up to, you know, $110+ on crude. And it seems like it's trying to crawl its way up. I mean, is this just going to be one little sideways correction and that breaks bullishly the upside? How does this play out?
Patrick, I do think it will break bullishly to the upside, but what's going on right now is a lot of different market participants have different perspectives. The people who think this is the Russia-Ukraine war, which is probably almost over, are expecting much lower prices. People who, in my opinion, correctly understand that this is just the Russia-Ukraine battle, which is the first hot conflict of World War III, understand that we're going much, much higher in prices. Inventory coming in at a drawdown of 2.2 million barrels this week. Frankly, I'm not even really that focused on inventory because I think the big picture here is really about the geopolitical escalation and where we're headed. So I'm going to make my biggest prediction ever on Macro Voices relative to the oil market. And that is that I believe that planet Earth just ran out of spare oil production capacity and almost nobody noticed. And what I mean by that, Patrick, is really until now, OPEC had enough spare capacity that although they allowed prices to go plenty high, when they want to bring them back down, they can adjust the dials and switches and get it back down to where they want it to. I think we've reached a point where OPEC is out of spare capacity. The one potential savior for this situation could be a shale revolution 2.0, if you will, in the United States, because I think the U.S. shale industry has already proven, or I should say has disproven, the predictions of so many people who said it could never get back to what it was before this collapse with the pandemic. They said it would never happen. Well, we're not there quite yet, but we're within, you know, a little over 1 million barrels of the all-time peak. It looks to me like there would be a potential that we could maybe get through the electrification phase. In other words, it's going to take at least a decade to really switch over to electrifying the economy and getting rid of fossil fuels as our primary source of energy. We could maybe, if we could really, really restart the U.S. shale revolution, get through that phase without a total crisis. Unfortunately, we have a presidential administration which has vilified the one industry that could actually save the economy. So I think this game is going to get a lot more serious now because energy affordability will become a gating factor to economic sustenance. It's not just whether people are happy or complaining about the price at the gas pump. It's a question of whether or not the cost of energy is going to completely collapse some of the smaller economies in the world and undermine the ability of other economies to grow. The price conundrum here is what George Soros calls reflexivity. In many ways, I think that we have a setup which is the most bullish imaginable setup for crude oil prices. But wait a minute. If crude oil prices get to a certain point, that can completely and totally cripple the economy and bring on a major recession. So you can only go so far with oil prices until oil prices themselves are the cause of major economic contractions, which of course result in at least temporarily lower oil prices. Wars get fought over shit like this, and hey, guess what? That's what's happening right now. This is only the very beginning, and I predict that if I'm right and we're out of spare capacity, the contention and the military escalations over energy are going to grow dramatically in coming years. Keep in mind, folks, from our interviews that we used to do years ago on Macro Voices about the fourth turning that we're in right now, the mistake that was made in the last fourth turning, which of course was the Great Depression and World War II, is everybody thought, okay, this fourth turning, clearly the Great Depression, that was the big deal, the big bad thing that was going to happen. They didn't realize that it's really at the end of the fourth turning, the last few years, that you get the really big bad thing, which in that case was World War II. It now seems that we're down to about 8 years left to run in the present fourth turning. And guess what? Looks like World War III has started. So I think the really bad news in this fourth turning was probably not the great financial crisis or the global pandemic, but what's still to come in the next few years. And I think that energy is going to be a central component of that story. Obviously, I'm going to ask Ola Hansen about this because it's one of the biggest predictions that I've ever made, and see if he agrees.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because obviously the pressure of the U.S. dollar rates and all these other things have really just put a drag on this, and gold is now breaking below the 1900 level where the lows were from back in March. What's your take here on how this plays out?
Well, no surprise at all that we've seen the weakness in gold, as we've been discussing on Macro Voices for the last several weeks. It's just really past clear now that all the things that the gold bugs predicted would take the price of gold way above 3,000 all came true, and the price didn't move. Guess what, folks? I was a gold bug once, too. Gold is shiny metal that's really good for making jewelry and some electronic parts. And with respect to its remonetization, I do think there's one angle that really has prospect. And that is if we see Russia and China, or some combination of Russia and China, or the two of them working together or something, propose a gold-backed digital currency as a competitor to the U.S. dollar for global trade and eventually as the global reserve currency. That would be the reason that I could say it really does make sense to be very bullish about gold in the long term, and there are signs that that may already be underway. But frankly, as I think this through and I see what we've seen with respect to the price of gold, if I'm trying to design a resource-backed digital currency system, although I did describe it as gold-backed in my book 4 years ago, as I think it through now, it makes much more sense to think about other resources like copper and crude oil as the backing behind a new digital currency system, because they're actually the important assets. Gold is shiny metal that's good for jewelry, and I admit to being faked out by the gold bug story like everybody else was, but it seems pretty darn clear to me that the gold bug thesis has been disproven.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury, and really the yields have approached that 3% level, but we've finally seen some of that devastating selling and that melt-up in rates really stall out here. Do you think we have seen some sort of a short-term high in yields, or you think there's more upside from here?
Oh, I think it's probably as simple as round number resistance at 3%. You know, we hit 3%, that spooked a few people, got some more bond bulls to jump into the market. We're only down, 15 basis points? So I think we need to wait and see what happens. It's entirely possible that that round number was kind of where this move ended and we're headed back below 2%. I doubt it, though. I think that a sustained move to a three handle would be a very telling sign, and I wouldn't be surprised if it comes pretty soon here.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank's Commodities Desk Chief, Ole Hansen. Eric, why did we get Ole back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, as we move into this war cycle, commodities become really the most important thing. Equity markets are, of course, going to continue to operate, but the commodities are going to be the thing that really makes the difference in terms of what happens to the economy. If we have shortages to the point where there's not enough food to feed entire countries, that's a bigger deal than a correction in the stock market. So I really wanted to get a commodities expert to comment now that we've seen this geopolitical escalation. I don't know anybody better than Ola for the mission.
Well, Eric's interview with Ole Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
With inflation reaching a 40-year high, investors are looking toward real assets to help safeguard their portfolio. One asset is rising in popularity. Farmland has consistently provided returns more than double the inflation rate since before 1992. How? Because farmland's value is underpinned by its critical role in the global economy. The country's growing population needs to eat. Farmland is well positioned to maintain its value over time, no matter the economic condition. As the supply of arable land in the United States shrinks each year, high-quality farmland should only become that much more valuable in the long run. Interested in adding farmland to your portfolio? Head to farmtogether.com. Farm Together is tapping into the nearly $3 trillion U.S. farmland market to bring unparalleled access to institutional quality farmland through a variety of products, including crowdfunded farmland offerings, 1031 exchange, sole ownership bespoke offerings, and most recently, the Sustainable Farmland Fund. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ola Hansen, who heads up the commodities desk at Saxo Bank. Ola prepared a terrific slide deck for today's interview. Listeners will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Ola, there have been times since I've known you that we've actually intentionally not booked you on Macro Voices because we just felt like the commodity sector was kind of quiet and there wasn't much to talk about. This is not one of those times. Holy cow. Where do we start? We've got World War III. We've got, a secular inflation that had begun before World War III. A lot of people are saying that the commodity supercycle catalyst was actually the pandemic that was going before we got to World War III. Where do we start and how do we reconcile this big picture? Let's just start at the highest level. How should we think about everything happening in the commodity space?
Well, thank you, Eric, for inviting me back. I think we just have to start by once again just realizing that commodity market is a finite market. Supply and demand needs to be balanced on a daily basis. That basically means when one is out of whack, we do get some big moves. What we've seen for quite a while now is that the market has increasingly become worried about the supply side. We had the stimulus-driven surge in growth following the pandemic. Then we had Putin turbocharging commodities, sanctions and war, creating a large mismatch across several commodities. And that was really what took us to these record highs that we actually booked a record high as late as last week, if you look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index. But since then, things have turned on a dime, and we have to throw another lockdown, another outbreak into the equation, this time obviously with China, where the lockdowns are spreading. China, key producer and key consumer of commodities, basically have thrown the whole thing into disarray right now once again. And I think on top of that, also a very aggressive expectation for how high interest rates will go in the US, thereby also adding some downward economic growth projection. So we have seen the market switch from worries about supply to worries about demand, and that's what we're really looking at this time. And that obviously raised the question whether it's over. We can take that a little bit later, but I think that's, from my perspective, that's really where we are right now.
Let's go ahead and get into the slide deck. I see on page 3 you're starting with surging inflation calls, and of course that was before the war cycle. Give us the whole rundown over the first few slides in the deck here about what's going on with inflation, what's going on with central bankers' response to inflation, and how do you think it's going to work out?
The first slide here just basically give an overview how we out of nowhere just suddenly seen this massive jump in inflation over the past year, culminating last month where we had 8.5% in the US and some double digits elsewhere as well. I actually left out Turkey because otherwise the colleague scheme was going to be whacked, because Turkey is with their 60+% right now would obviously have made the United States at 8.5% look pretty muted. So that's removed. So it just gives it a highlight. Gives an idea about how we are turning more and more red on the inflation front. Central banks have been very slow in responding because first they had to deal with the recovery after the pandemic, and that basically means that this market has been allowed to run ahead of itself, and with the consequence that we have overstimulated the economy, we have suddenly seen scarcity of supplies, we've supply bottlenecks as well, adding to the equation, and that's left us where we are. And central banks really need to respond, and I think that's we're seeing that most clearly in the U.S. Last year, when Powell was reappointed, I'm sure he was read the Riot Act by the White House. Stop focusing on jobs. Start focusing on inflation, because there's only a few hundred thousand out of more than that out of work, but there are millions of people suffering from inflation, inflationary pressures. And in brackets, I also have a midterm election to run to win later this year. So that has basically seen a massive shift in the stance of the central bank, and on slide 4 we can now see just using the data from the market that the market is pricing in 10 rate hikes now by February next year. So obviously we are about to expand on a massive rate hike cycle, and it is needed, because even if you look at the longer term inflation perspective projections using inflation swaps, 2 years still it's around 4.5%. That's obviously well too high. 10 years, somewhat more muted, around 3%. And the question is really whether they will succeed to bring down inflation at this point before the growth starts to have been negatively impacted. Because that's really the essence. And if you look at if you move to of what we have to be aware of, that central banks cannot control the availability or lack of availability of key input materials like commodities. So they can only really impact the demand side. So right now they are out on a mission to basically kill demand in order to bring down prices. And obviously when you kill demand, you're also killing growth. So the question is really whether we are going to see growth play ball, i.e. that we see a managed slowdown in growth with these rate hikes, or whether we're going to head towards something more serious in terms of recession. The jury is out on that, but that is really the balancing act the central bank needs to ride over the coming months. And I think at the same time, we also have to consider China. They are the lockdowns now is really having a serious impact on growth. They have a promise to the party, has a promise to the people to ensure stability and growth, and that basically means that when we get on the other side of these lockdowns, they will come in with a massive stimulus program, I believe, in order to support the economy. That will bring back demand for commodities, and that's the reason why we still see commodities move on the upside. And I think it's all basically just put into slide 5, where we just see some of these the changes and the differences that we experience in the commodity market over the past year or so. We are obviously using the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index, which tracks 24 major commodities. We are at a record level. As I mentioned, we saw a record high last week. We saw a record quarter, basically 24% in one quarter. That is obviously unsustainable on the long run. So that also, so the timing of the slowdown we see now is probably quite, it's a good timing of that, because we needed this market to consolidate, because the continued rally of that would obviously be incredibly unsustainable. What we're seeing, the market has moved towards more and more tightness. That you can see on the top right-hand chart, basically using the implied roll yield, the one-year spread between spot and 12 months out. For half a decade, and that's really the reason why a lot of investors have been scrambling to get back into commodities. But for half a decade, we had ample supply, basically meaning that we had markets trading in contango. So you basically had a negative roll yield by a passive long investment in a commodity ETF. And that has only really changed now over the past couple of years, to the point that we are looking at almost record backwardations, which basically means that if you believe that we are in 12 months time, we'll see unchanged prices, i.e. not going up, not going down, you would basically be holding an ETF with tracking the Bloomberg Commodity Index, you would make 7%. And obviously, if there's a price increase at the same time, that you can add on top of the gains you will make, just simply by the rolling of position from month to month, where you are selling high and buying the next month at a lower rate. So that's adding investment demand into commodities. We're seeing a little bit of a slowdown recently. Prompt spreads, the number of contracts in prompt in backwardation has dropped down back down to 14. That's out of 29 commodities. It's 626. I can't count. We'll make it up. You can see the numbers at the bottom. I think it's 28 commodities actually. So half roughly is trading in backwardation. That peaked at around 22 just a few weeks ago. So this is the underlying thesis that is driving demand for commodities. And there are plenty of reasons why we are seeing that. But obviously I'm not going to talk for nonstop for an hour. So I'll just give it back to you, Eric.
Ola, it seems to me like in normal times, the Fed is working as hard as they can, or central banks around the world are working as hard as they can to try to avoid a recession, to try to manage the economy so we don't have a recession. And, you know, it's much harder to try to prevent bad things from happening than causing them to happen. Now, I'm convinced that the Fed is very necessarily trying to cause a recession for the necessary purpose of dealing with inflation. Seems to me like they've got all the tools they need to cause one. So it's hard for me to even understand why people question, do you think there's a chance we could be headed toward recession? It seems very clear to me that we're going to get a recession, but I don't think that they need to make that recession last any longer than it takes to get demand under control. Or maybe they do. And so how does this sort of forward-looking way that monetary policy works, how does that intersect with what you described in the beginning, where commodity supply and demand really has to be balanced every day?
I think the risk of a recession, especially in the US, is probably low, but obviously you can't rule it out. Going from employment as workforce as strong as it is right now to a recession, that would require a massive break, which I don't see will happen. But we will see a slowdown, and obviously when the slowdown starts, then again, the ball starts rolling. How quickly can you arrest that slide when you get to a level in terms of inflation that you are satisfied with? And especially as well, what happens if you do not manage to get inflation under control? And that's where I think that's really where the big differ is right now, because if you're looking on a year-to-year basis, we should probably see a peak in commodity inflation fairly soon. But what happens if these supply bottlenecks, they are maintained? What happens if we are seeing a world where there's not enough investment going into new discoveries for oil and for mined metals? What happens if we have more years with food supply risks as we have right now? Then the prospect of inflation starting to slow from the commodity input side, I think is relatively muted. And I think just on page six, just to look at the real capital expenditure we've seen over the past few decades, we are back to levels that we haven't seen for 20 years. So we're seeing results from the major oil companies this week, and we really need to see them step up their capex spend in order to ensure that we do have enough oil for the foreseeable future. And I think adding to that, look at the projected urban versus rural population in the world. That's at the urban population will continue to rise, and that will continue to be that will be commodity to heavy over the coming years. Just a place like India, say, I had a colleague one day saying that, well, India in terms of urbanization is at the level where US was in 1910. So it's just there's still just massive amount of investment has to come through that natural transition towards the cities, and that's just something I think we in the Western world probably sometimes fail to pick up, that there's still a massive move happening in Asia and elsewhere. So that will require investments. If those investments don't materialize, then we do have an issue. We have the green transition. Just look at Europe, where we're suffering from you complaining about $7 gas. We are looking at $30-$40 gas in Europe, and it's punitively expensive. We're taking a hit on this, but we also at the same time we want to get rid of dependency on Russian supplies, and that really means that the political will to step up the green transition is there. And we all know green transition is anything but green. It requires a heck of a lot of all the black stuff and all the metals as well. So that demand will continue to remain robust.
Ola, there's a theme I've been discussing on Macro Voices for several years, which is if we are, in fact, at the beginning of a secular inflation, if this is, for the first time since the late 1960s, well, what that means is that there's nobody still alive in the industry who's been through that before and truly has the experience of knowing how to trade it. That tends to surprise the heck out of people, particularly in the commodity sector, where, people want to look and say, well, but wait, it's already above the five-year average. It can't go any higher. And it's like, No, it's a different game now. We're in a secular inflation, and people are just not used to the rules of the game changing. That was certainly what blindsided so many people in the early 1970s as the great inflation really took off. I see page 7 is titled, What Drives a Commodity Supercycle? Please tell us, and particularly with regard to what is it going to mean if we really are in kind of a new paradigm of secular inflation that nobody really has experienced with?
Well, quite simple. It is a super cycle. It's driven by a prolonged period where you have a mismatch between demand, which can be rising, and inelastic supply. We have to remember that mining, looking for new mining capabilities, can easily take 5 years from the beginning to actually starting to mine these metals. And a spare thought for the oil majors, where you would be, apart from shale oil, you are often looking at a 5-10 year horizon. And are the oil majors prepared to bet on the global oil demand in 10 years' time? That, I think, is really one of the key questions that they are asking themselves. And also wonder the reason why they are not that particularly aggressive in terms of going out and trying to benefit from these very high prices we see right now, because some of these projects do take a long time and even further out in order for them to become profitable. So I think that is what we're facing. So let's just say demand is going to be stable. Let's say we have a slowdown in growth in the Western world. Not so much a thing in China, because that we will have to see a stimulus-led recovery there. But then adding to that the greenflation, the investment into renewables, I think that with that in mind, we just have the foundation for a continued rally. And I think we also have to remember this rally we've seen so far has really happened without a weaker dollar. The dollar has actually been strengthening. So that just makes the rally even more phenomenal. What happens if we do get a hit through in the dollar and we start to see weakness start to kick in? Not that it looks like it's in the card anytime soon, but I think there's still a over risk that the dollar will eventually start to weaken again. That will just add some more fuel to the fire. So basically, simply a prolonged period of mismatch between the demand and supply.
Ola, I'm seeing more and more credible analysts going on record saying, look, we're headed toward a global food shortage crisis. And they're not talking about the price of coffee going up so that Starbucks is more expensive. They're talking about widespread areas of famine and death in parts of the world that are impoverished and shortages and simply cannot get it at any price kind of situations for important food supplies. A lot of this is driven by the need to fertilize the crops, which, of course, you've got to have the potash to make the fertilizer. And the whole situation with Russia and Ukraine has put a lot of that at risk. Where is all this headed? And what would a global... are these analysts right? Should we really be thinking about global food crisis on the level of famine and so forth? Or are we just talking about higher prices at Starbucks?
I think that the risk is most certainly there, and again, if it becomes more paramount than it is visible than it is right now, it will, as per usual, hit those that least can afford it, and that will be in key food importing countries, some of which are also a major importer of fuel. So I think the risk is there. I think the what we're seeing so far in the U.S. in terms of weather is not a good omen, because we need a bumper crop from Canada and the U.S. this year. And so far, I think I'm stuck here in sunny Copenhagen, but it's been fluctuating very much, the temperatures as well. But it looks like the U.S. is just dealing with a place too hot, other place too warm, too cold, and too wet, and the mismatch of everything. So we got wheat quality, winter wheat quality at the lowest in 12 years. We got the planting of corn has kicked off at a very, very slow pace. We got Ukraine, where potentially 40% of the corn and wheat crop could may never be produced. And these are big numbers, because we have to remember that the Ukrainian soil is some of the best in the world. And they produce some fantastic high protein products, which are perfect for human consumption. And that's why it's in terms of tonnage of the total global production, it's maybe not that high, but in terms of what's going towards human consumption, it is a very notable level. We see sunflower oil, Ukraine, a major export of that. Palm oil, as a consequence, is rocketing right now. It's anything from soap to shampoo to food production that's being impacted by that. So I think there is a risk. And again, the main driver in any normal year, because it's relatively easy to project demand for food commodities, because there's only so and so much we can eat. That is really the weather. And so far, the weather is not playing ball. And then added to that this year, the really disastrous situation we got in Ukraine.
Energy is the other really big important commodity in a situation like this, and boy, it's on fire. The thing that I really have a hard time reconciling, Ola, is I can easily make an argument in my head that says, look, if I look at everything going on with this war cycle, the inflation, everything else, I can easily make an argument for crude oil well north of $200 a barrel. The thing is, I know that crude oil north of $200 a barrel will break the economy, and it won't take very long for it to happen. And of course, that's going to crush demand. So if there's something that I would think eventually does bring a recession, it would be if energy prices really start to go out of control. And frankly, it seems to me like we've got an awfully ripe setup for that to happen. What are your reactions? Would you agree with any of that, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I think the we have, so to say, been saved in terms of price rises in the short term, not only by the SPR, which obviously won't last forever, and then also the outbreak of or the lockdowns in China, which has probably removed demand for between 1 and 2 million barrels a day. That's the reason why we are at the back to around the 100 level or was close to 100 level, and we are close in Brent, and we are at 100 level in WTI. But if we both of these are short term, they will eventually go away, and then what we're left with is still a large swathe of the world which are very skeptical about Russia. I think as long as the current leadership is in place, the sanctions may not necessarily be lifted, even though we had a peace deal tomorrow, because the relationship has become so toxic and has broken down to the extent that parts of the world will try to avoid buying fuel, gas and oil from Russia. And that basically means that all the other producers, they will be selling at higher prices than normal. And adding to that also on slide 11, the fact that OPEC Plus is really struggling to meet their own quotas. OPEC meetings have, at least for now, become irrelevant, because they don't want to address the elephant in the room, which is Russia, and their inability to meet their targets due to sanctions and what have you. But looking at this, it's really only the GC nations in the Middle East that continue to raise production according to the quotas, whereas most others are currently struggling. And then we also have Iran and Venezuela, where sanctions are preventing them from raising production. So all this just leaves us in a precarious spot, and I think it is one that will continue to underpin the price. But your trade as well, Eric, you know also the technical setup. If we do break lower for whatever reason over the coming days, could be in a deterioration in the situation in China. We break 98, we could have a 5 to 10% down move in crude oil for just purely from a technical reason. Hedge funds have actually been scaling back positions in recent months. Part of that is due to margin calls and high volatility, which means they have to cut down their nominal exposure. But perhaps also just a hint of some worries about one thing, that supply will be tight, but perhaps also that the demand will start to suffer as interest rates are being raised. But I think the long-term prospect, the long-term structural issues that the oil market is facing won't go away, and that will continue to underpin the price. You talked about the 200 in terms of killing the economy. I think we're seeing here in Europe already, and that's on slide 12, the European gas oil contract, the ICE low sulfur gasoil contract, which is basically diesel. We have hit levels already where industries are scaling back. I was on a Danish radio recently just to in a part of a program where they were asking where the Danish fishing industry were pretty close to basically calling it a halt because some of the old vessels just simply could not make money at with the diesel prices that they had reached. Luckily, we have come down a little bit, but we are still in very high territory, and that also basically brings us to the point that it's not crude oil we need to look at when it comes to demand destruction. It is obviously the refined products, and both gasoline and diesel have not really corrected that much from the highs we saw a couple of months ago. Refinery margins as a consequence are record high, and that also highlight a market that is stressed because the demand for diesel and gasoline, especially diesel, is very robust, and especially also here in Europe, because again, I'm sure a lot of consumers in Europe, when they were filling up their car with diesel or gasoline, they didn't have a clue that most of that was actually coming from Russia. But it does come from Russia. I think close to half of that, and that basically means that again we have to look for our products elsewhere, and that's just adding upward pressure on the price because it's in a very competitive market.
Well, something that has shocked me is I've seen credible analysts in the oil industry remarking that, look, you know, don't get worried about $200 oil. Saudi Arabia doesn't want $200 oil. It doesn't benefit them. They haven't taken action yet, but they're not going to let it get anywhere close to that because as soon as it gets over 125, 150 in there somewhere, they're going to turn the screws up and they're going to tap all of that massive spare capacity that they have. I think these folks are nuts. I don't think Saudi Arabia or anyone else in OPEC has any spare capacity left. If they did, I think they'd already be doing what they could. Am I missing something?
Nope, you're absolutely right. And I think we have to remember that Saudi Arabia has been pumping oil out of the same hole for the past, 40, 50 years. And as you continue, then the quality will start to deteriorate. You'll need more and more water in order to maintain pressure and so on. So I think the Saudis, their lack of response to the current situation, I suppose, is twofold. They obviously want to stay on good terms with Russia. They built up a close relationship over the past few years through the OPEC Plus cooperation. But I think also generally I think there is a worry that they may actually not have that spare capacity. And the same goes for some of the other producers that the market is looking for, especially when we have a situation like this where as I showed on one of the previous slides, where just three countries, Nigeria, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea, they produce around 500,000 barrels less than their quota. The fact that they don't step in and temporarily to say, okay, we'll mitigate that by producing more ourselves, that hasn't happened. And that does indicate to me that they are pretty close to running at full throttle.
Our listeners know the expression that the cure for high prices is high prices, but I want to talk about the timetable. Let's imagine that starting tomorrow morning, there's this great big epiphany, and all the folks that previously thought it was a good idea to phase out fossil fuels before phasing in their replacement suddenly realize that we really, really need to invest in oil production and exploration and really increase global spare capacity. And we need to start making those investments and start making them right now. But there's one thing, which is, as you said earlier, global commodity markets have to be balanced in supply and demand right now, not based on something that's coming online later. How long does it take if we came to our senses and really put investment into the oil sector tomorrow, something that's not really going to happen? How long does it take before we get to the point where we don't have to worry about this spare capacity problem anymore?
Well, if frackers in the U.S. could get hold of enough sand, water, and labor and truckers, then we may start to see some kind of support relatively quickly. But they seem to be struggling on all accounts with regards to that. I'm obviously sitting very, very far away from this. I'm not an expert at all, but at least that's what I read and what I see. So if it comes to the deep sea exploration projects that we've seen in the past in places like Brazil, we are looking at several years, potentially half a decade, and that is obviously much longer than the market can cope with. When we are looking at as you said, this market that needs to be balanced on a daily basis. So with supply not forthcoming, then again, it's really only one side of the equation that can give, and that's the demand side. And that's again the high price does play its part. We're seeing that already in Europe. The problem with food is obviously not that's much more tricky, because we need food and water. We can scale back and change our habits when it comes to mobility, and put building the projects on hold if we can't get the source, the metal, or the material that we require. But what I try to convey to our clients that even if we have an economic slowdown, commodities can still go up. Because it is a supply and demand market. If we are struggling with on the supply side, and even if demand is potentially slowing, then it doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to see the happy days of low prices return.
Let's talk about what the high price is that really breaks the economy. Because some people would say, well, when we got to $147 a barrel in 2008, you know, clearly that was the number that we just can't tolerate that. But if you inflation adjust that, it's like 225 or so in today's dollars. We got a long way to go before we're back there. So how much room do we have before the cost of energy really becomes the factor that breaks the economy?
I think if we see the return to the levels in gasoline and diesel that we saw just around the panic surge back around the time when the war broke out, if we return to those kind of levels, then for sure we will see disruptions on a global scale, and I think that's basically almost enough. So if current margins are being maintained between crude oil and the products, then it doesn't really take more than crude oil returning to the highs that we've already seen for a sustainable period. If that occurs, then we do have a problem. And I think also, what's different this time compared to previous spikes in commodities is the fact that it's just across all three major sectors. Normally, from time to time, you had an oil crisis where you had maybe a geopolitical risk, Middle East or Libya, what have you. You maybe in the metal market, you had strike action in South America, or you had other issues at play, potentially supporting metals for a shorter period of time. Food commodities obviously fluctuate with weather up and down, but this time around, because Russia is the second biggest exporter of everything, of many commodities, it is just happening. It's why it's so painful, because it's hurting all three sectors at the same time, and the prospects for that to ease anytime soon obviously doesn't look like it's forthcoming.
It seems to me, Ola, that there is a very specific time marker on the near horizon, and what I'm talking about is very specifically to where you live in Europe. Right now, we're coming into spring, and the fact that Europe is so dependent on Russian gas for heating, and I'm talking now about propane, not about gasoline. The gas market in Europe, where a lot of the residential heating comes from, and as well as heating everything else, it comes from Russia. And, you know, in the springtime, you don't have to worry too much about losing your heat. If we get to the autumn, when we're starting to get to freezing temperatures in Europe, and all of the sudden there's a political escalation and Russia shuts the valve off, I've heard a lot of different analysts talk about how big of a deal that would be for Europe. And I'm not sure who's right. So how big of a deal would that be for Europe? And what can be done between now and the fall to mitigate those risks?
Well, first of all, a political will to support and help pay for gas outside of Russia to rebuild our storage levels. We can see that on slide 13 in the deck, that we actually had a reasonably good start to the rebuilding process. Gas in storage in Europe has picked up quite well the last few weeks, and that's part of that is due to we've had a bit of a warm spell here, but also strong arrivals of LNG, especially from US. The problem right now is that the summer winter ARP simply doesn't work, because normally summer gas prices would be quite a bit lower than the winter price. October to March. Right now, the summer, the spot price in Europe is around 100. Actually, we rallied today because there are signs that Polish supplies through Poland is being turned off. But we'll know more about that over the coming days. But we're trading north of 100 euros a megawatt hour. That is basically higher than where we are trading for the coming winter, which is somewhere in the just below that. So you have no economic incentive to buy gas put it into storage and sell it at a higher price during the winter period. So that basically means that it requires a political will, which I probably think we will find, to ensure that we get these gas storage levels up to decent levels, because Russia is a lost case right now. We're looking at the again on slide 13, you can see Gazprom has basically brought down the storage levels. That they have four controlled EU facilities. I think now they only have three, because I think one was taken over by the German authorities in order to ensure supplies. But it has basically come almost to nothing. So we're facing a very challenging summer in terms of getting gas supplies rebuilt. But even at these current prices, I just last week had a bit of shock. I paid $3.50 for a cucumber, and that's US dollars. That I've never, I only seen that in Norway, where my wife is from. They pay the highest prices, both for diesel and gasoline, even though they produce a lot of it, but they also pay a very high price for food items. But a cucumber cost me $3.50, basically because obviously the greenhouses they can't operate with gas prices at these levels. So we will see more of that over the coming weeks and months if we don't start to see these prices come down. And again, you mentioned oil before, and that duration of the how long it could take before we get supplies rebuilt. The same goes for gas. There are some low-hanging fruits, increased supplies from Norway, increased imports via LNG. And potentially over time, if we ever should become friends with the Iranians again, then I think Iran is probably sitting on the world's biggest gas reserve. So there's plenty of gas to tap in there if the political will is there. But again, this doesn't happen overnight. That could easily take years.
Ola, at the height of the pandemic, the big supply chain issue was semiconductors and also anything pertaining to home construction, because there was a big boom in people trying to get out of cities and build homes in the country and so forth. My building friends tell me that the escape COVID building boom is definitely slowing down. It seems like the semiconductor stuff's coming into line, but I'm hearing that broader commodities are not so much a price issue, but just can't get it. There's a lot of supply chain issues with availability of, you know, just things like copper and nickel and aluminum and so forth. What's going on there? What's driving it, and where is it headed?
Well, right now we're seeing some profit taking on slides 14. You can see I've just put in high grade copper. We broke the uptrend from the 2020 low, and that is again that's technical driven and based on worries about what's happening in China right now. But I think we just need to stay focused here, because China will come back. They will increase spending. They will stimulate the economy. They cannot live with the growth so much below 5.5 where it's heading right now. They will stimulate growth. I think that growth will be not in heavy industries. They will not be building any more steel mills, but they will be looking at the green transformation as well. They'll be looking at at projects that is in that part of the economy. And again, that will require plenty of industrial metals, and especially something like copper. And I think looking at the supply side of copper, we had recent elections both in Chile and Peru. There's a growing demand for a bigger slice of the revenues that the copper mining industries they produce in Chile and Peru, and that potentially could challenge their ability to grow and expand the business. Chile is running into a 13th year drought, and the water is a scarcity in the capital. It's scarcity around the country, and the water is a major source required for the mining of copper. So there's just plenty of obstacles. And the green transformation in Europe, which we for sure will be heading towards. If you are a normal household in Denmark, as an example, use around 4,000 kilowatt. If you then buy an electrical car, you use 8,000 kilowatt. If you then buy a heat pump because you don't want expensive gas bills, it probably goes up to around 12,000 kilowatt. All that kilowatt has to be delivered to your house, and through a grid that is probably will start to choke eventually, because it simply cannot cope with that kind of capacity increase. That again requires a hell of a lot of investments going into the infrastructure, and that's again where I think copper is sitting right in the middle. So I'm very bullish on copper. Can't deny that. It's been a range-bound market for the past year because it is the metal that's primarily is mostly used as a from a macroeconomic perspective as well, and that basically means that it has been struggling given some of the adversity we've seen with the interest rates starting to go up. But at the end of the day, supply and demand rules. Demand will go up, supply will be tight, and that makes me believe that we will see record highs in copper eventually.
Ola, let's move on to precious metals, a subject near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts. I guess my view has been quite unpopular in the precious metals community. It seems to me like, for the most part, all of those predictions the gold bugs made that was going to send the price of gold to $5,000 came true. We've got massive, massive, you know, expansion of central bank balance sheets. We're debasing the currency. We've got inflation. Looks to me like this inflation is going to be a secular inflation that is going to last a long time. All the things that we're going to send the gold price to the moon happened, except the gold price, which in my eye, hasn't really gone anywhere. Am I missing something?
Nope, you're not. And if you are gold bug and you're only trading gold, you're obviously sitting there feeling pretty let down. But if you are looking at your gold as part of a portfolio, I think it's doing great. If you are obviously in dollar terms, gold is only up around 4% this year. But if you take the dollar strength into account that we've seen so far this year, if you're here in Europe, I would be looking at I'm currently looking at a 22% outperformance against the European stock index, the Euro Stoxx 50. I'm looking at a 19% outperformance against the core position of bonds. So with that in mind, I'm very happy holding a gold position. So why hasn't it moved? Well, it hasn't moved for several reasons. I mean, the first one and the reason why a lot of banks were actually quite negative on gold at the beginning of the year was this prospect of really us going to zero. Well, hey, we are at zero now, and we have rallied by 1% during the past few months. Gold hasn't moved. That does indicate, or actually gold has been moving up. That does indicate there are other and bigger fish to fry right now. And I think those are a combination of very strong retail demand, because you and me and everyone else, Eric, a year ago, inflation was something we talked about as something that might happen, not really. And many of the US probably haven't lived at a time where inflation was actually an issue. I remember when my dad had to buy an extension to, I come from a farm, and back in the 80s, the loan was 20%. I think we haven't seen that in the Western world for many years. So many people just simply doesn't. Inflation was something abstract. Now, fast forward a year, and boy, we can all feel it on our pocket, how everything is just going through the roof and inflation is starting to rise. Your mortgage rates are going up. Your food items you're buying at the supermarket is going up. The cost of filling your car going up. The cost of building anything is going up to the point that builders right now, they won't give you a quote because they say we simply don't know what the price will be tomorrow. So you'll just have to accept that you will bill you when we go out and buy the goods that we need to for your building project. And so it's not abstract anymore. It's something we feel, and that basically means as that it's create a reaction among investors, because they said, well, how can I protect myself against this? And they'll look across the space. Some will look at Bitcoin, and I'm sure a lot of people have been looking at gold. So retail demand is strong. Central bank demand remains firm. And then also the big change from last year is basically the fact that asset managers have started to return to gold. Last year, they of 2020, they piled into gold in anticipation of stimulus bringing inflation, which then didn't materialize, and asset prices that would dump. Last year, we had a very, very strong year across the equity market, so the need for diversification was not there. So we just saw a steadily selling off of asset managers holding in gold last year. That you can see that through the ETF holdings. Ever since the beginning of December last year, we've seen holdings almost rise on a daily basis. They are making a change in their portfolio. They are hedging themselves against a so-called policy mistake from the central bank that they kill growth too fast and too soon, and thereby having to reverse some of their tightening. And at the same time, they're also we're seeing this incredible volatility, especially in the bond market, but also in the stock market. That is something you want to guard yourself against. And then, obviously, in addition to that, we have the war in Ukraine, which is where we go from a nuclear threat one day to something obviously much less sinister the next. But all in all, just all the drivers that will attract demand for gold. Recently, and that's why I put this in on slide 16, a key driver for gold has actually been crude oil. And I think that makes perfect sense because crude oil right now is an inflation gauge. It's also a geopolitical risk gauge. So when crude oil comes down, gold has been struggling a bit. And I think that's part of the, together with what we've seen in China now for the past few weeks here, that's the reason why gold has come down, because oil prices come down. We believe oil prices will find a plateau and move up again. And I think the prospect for an economic slowdown to the extent that rate hikes may have to be paused at one point, will continue to add demand for gold, even though we got this rise in real yields.
Ola, we've got just a few minutes left. I've got to see a couple of slides here about agriculture and so forth, but what I'm most interested in is how should our audience think about putting money to work in this sector as we look at all of these catalysts for a major supercycle? Is it about buying the commodities? Is it about buying equities in the companies that produce the commodities? How do we play this? What do we do? How do you make money on this?
I think in the short term, Eric, we an exposure to the actual commodities is the best option, because we are currently looking at a stock market which is not exactly falling out of bed, but it's most certainly not doing well. There is a risk that we could see even steeper losses, and that will send some of the commodity related companies lower. But based on our view that commodities will remain firm, and that basically also means that the profitability of some of these companies will remain incredibly strong. That means that we should be looking for opportunities over time. But in the short term, potentially buying into the actual underlying commodities, I see as the best way forward. There are decent amount of ETFs available. I like the broad exposure, given the kind of volatility that we're seeing. You mentioned agriculture. It is an area which I would like to avoid, but obviously because again from the repercussions that it has for food prices, that is speculative buying going into the sector. So the broad exposure where we primarily focus on the metals and the energy, but we can see from looking at the companies that. We created several equity themes at Saxo Bank over the past year or so. We just find that as it's telling us a much, much better story than if you're looking at sectors and what have you, because then you can spread across markets, spread across countries, and just basically pick out some of the main contributors to the different sectors. And looking here on slide 20, you can see these 20 companies, and you can see how basically right now it is at the top of the heap, even though we've seen this current correction still up 50% year to over the past year. So a mix, but companies will do great over the coming years. I think there's no doubt about that.
Ola, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners what you guys do at Saxo Bank and how people can follow your work.
Well, Saxo Bank is a global provider of access to markets. We got offices around the world, I think with the exception of North America, actually. But we serve as a global client base. And my role is covering commodities from a broad perspective. I'm not a specialist. I'm a bit more of a generalist because I focus across markets. But we have a tight-knit team, work together best part of 10 years, where we support each other, and that basically results in daily outputs. So we have a daily podcast, which I'll highly recommend. It's been growing in size over the past 2 years. It's just look up Saxo Market Call, and you can find that on your favorite podcast app. And otherwise, we have you can look up to our research hub, analysis.saxo. Obviously, you're always welcome to follow me on Twitter at Ollie_S_Hansen with an E.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. For decades, quantitative hedge funds like Renaissance, Citadel, and Two Sigma have benefited from the development of systematic or rules-based trading. Renaissance's Medallion Fund returned 66% per year from 1998 through 2018. Medallion is run by an army of data scientists, mathematicians, and neural engineers that build code to take advantage of exogenous market movements. There's a reason why over $1 trillion is managed in quantitative hedge funds. However, unless you have a PhD or a Python expert, building trading algorithms has been next to impossible. Until now. Composer is a VC-backed startup that lets anyone build quantitative strategies for free. No code or Excel required. With Composer, you can easily build strategies with their drag-and-drop, no-code visual editor. Or invest in their pre-vetted strategies, like paired switching S&P 500 and bonds, or buy the dips NASDAQ. To learn more, go to composer.trade today. That's composer.trade today.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Ollie back on the show. His insights into commodities are always fascinating, and it's always a great update to get him to get his perspectives on everything. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I think the most important thing Ola said in the entire interview was actually just a comment he made in passing near the beginning when he said that commodity markets must be balanced in terms of supply and demand each and every day. Because unlike equity markets, where we can be forward-looking and anticipate what's going to happen in the future and think about prices in terms of what forward earnings look like as opposed to the current situation, in commodities markets, we have to think about the physical supply and demand of commodities and getting them to where they're needed. And as I look back to something like having gotten the call right on the pandemic, you know, I went short both crude oil futures and stock index futures. I had much more leverage on crude oil because that's what I trade mostly, but I was thinking I really needed to diversify that view and be short both equities and crude oil. Well, in hindsight, that one lesson that commodities, unlike stocks, have to be balanced in terms of supply and demand, and you can't just forward look your way through it. They have to resolve the physical supply issues in order to work it out. That's the reason that crude oil actually went to negative prices during the pandemic, but of course, stocks never went anything close to that. So I think that commodities, if you really understand what's going on, are going to be a much, much more opportune space to trade in for the next decade than stocks. And I think it's really important to take that message to heart. In any event, let's move on to this week's post-game chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button above Ola's picture that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, the deck is titled Technical Crossroads, and sure enough, on page two, we've got S&P 500 futures. What's going on here?
Well, you know, I wanted to zoom out to a weekly chart and really kind of put in context the comments you made at the market wrap at the beginning. Like when you really reflect on how the price of equities have performed over the last 2 years since the COVID lows, you know, this market correction that we have been in has been relatively tame and contained. Just to put it into context, in order to just retrace 50% of the prior rise, it would involve a 25%+ market correction down to 3,500, where I know there's a number of prominent macro strategists that have talked about that number even a year ago. And the point here is that we now have traded right down to that March low from just a couple months ago. And what we find ourselves in a situation where the big question is, will we see that S&P break to a fresh low? And does that create a short-term liquidity event where the selling feeds on itself in a negative gamma way that basically creates like an air pocket drop that the market is so typical of doing when things get out of hand? We'll be watching very closely this previous low and what it does there. Now, to put that into context, on page three, I wanted to just highlight that percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average breadth indicator. And what I wanted to simply highlight was the fact that we have now reached the oversold state that prior market corrections have ended in. Now, it's not necessarily a forecast that that means this one will turn, but we have now seen oversold conditions enough that if it was just a market correction, then this would be typically where, at least it has in the past over the last year or two, marked a short-term tradable low on the market. And the interesting part, and this is what I mean by crossroad, is that if we see that March low given out on the stock market, then we're talking about a breadth indicator that could be heading down towards those COVID March lows, and where we get some very extreme oversold conditions. And certainly it would no longer fit the criteria of a correction, but rather it could even start getting into bear market territory if we saw that. And the other thing to kind of collaborate that is looking at the volatility index, or the VIX, on page 4. And most market corrections tend to contain themselves to just these quick little spikes up to 30. And then we see a reversal of the trend as dealer buying forces a slingshot rally the other way. And so we have now reached that stage on the volatility index where we have typically seen short-term lows on the stocks emerge. And so this is what I mean by the technical crossroad, is that it's an important moment where we're going to find out, does the stock market behave the way it's been behaving in the last year, which is put in a short-term low, or are we about to see the floodgate open and something more ominous is about to occur?
Patrick, I think that's a brilliant insight, but I want to take it a little bit further and just come to some conclusions. You're saying this is the crossroads. So if I look back to page 2, would I be correct to interpret your whole prognostication here to be that if we break decisively below that top red line, which looks like it's at about 4,200 or so, if we break below that line and it's a sustained move, then you think 50% retracement down at 35 something is the next logical target?
Certainly, a 50% retracement of the prior rise is a very typical target. I mean, obviously, that's not necessarily a forecast as much as a reasonable target zone to anticipate. And I know we've heard a number of macro strategists even calling for 3,000 or lower. But I think a starting point for a deeper market correction that would leave the market in that kind of 20 to 30% market correction territory if we saw that kind of a downdraft. I'm not so sure that the market will make the break, but if it does, it should happen relatively quickly. And in the 3,500, I think, is a very reasonable target for a downdraft to go.
Patrick, let's move on to page 5. I'm going to make the statement that this crossroads is absolutely as important as the equity crossroad that you talked about, because the high that we had back in 2016, I think it was 104 spot something, looks like we're just coming up on that again. Seems to me if we break above this line, that was the prior high of 104 spot something from 2016, really, the sky's the limit. We're looking at probably back up to 120 or so, which was the high from the early 2000s. We got to higher numbers way back in the early 80s, but barring that, you know, it's almost all-time high kind of targeting that I'm looking at. And I think we probably could get to an all-time high in the U.S. dollar before eventually, 10 years from now, we get to a replacement for the dollar, in which case the dollar is going to go the way of the pound sterling and it won't be pretty. But that's not happening yet.
Right. Well, I wanted to just zoom out on the monthly chart just to put this into context, because when we look at it on the daily chart, obviously it's been a little bit of a parabolic rise, but it's not only that we've approached that 2016-17 kind of high, but the last time the dollar traded above that level was going back to 2001 period. And so if the dollar was to break out above these levels, it takes us into a territory of not uncharted waters, but certainly one that really asks the question as to whether a dollar bull market has been set in motion that is could stay in trend for years. The key here, obviously, we're quite overbought, and usually, and it's a typical response, is for the prices as they approach these kind of key overhead resistance levels to bump their head and stall out a little bit along there. And so I'm not necessarily impressed implying that we are going to get this monstrous breakout this week. And more importantly, when looking at monthly charts, one has to look at this as multi-year trends and not necessarily, you know, what's going to happen next week. We are at a very important moment. This chart, I would argue, is way more important than the equity chart because the implications of a brand new U.S. dollar bull market resuming with a push back to like 2000 to 2001 highs would have profound impacts on the macro space. And this is the thing that we should be continuously talking about throughout the year for sure.
Patrick, I want to add one more comment because as investors, our job is to always question how could we be getting it wrong. The reason I think we're going much higher is because I'm convinced that Russia-Ukraine is not a conflict unto itself, but rather just a battle in the context of a much larger war that's going to go on for many years to come. If I've got that all wrong and the whole Russia-Ukraine thing is about to de-escalate, get resolved, everybody's going to kiss and make up, Vladimir Putin is no longer considered a bad guy, and everybody's happy, then the dollar's done here and it's going to go straight back down. I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately, but that would be the case is if I've got the war picture wrong, and it really is Russia-Ukraine is an isolated thing, then once that's over, it's over. That would be the case where I think the dollar is, if anything, very much overbought and due for a big correction. I don't think it's going to go that way, though. Let's move on to crude oil on page 6. We've got a triangle pattern here. What I've been waiting for is the break above that upper trend line on the triangle. I think it's coming. Not sure when. I'm almost certain that it will be news-driven. And I think that it will also cause technical traders to really start to jump on, and we'll see a new rally up to whatever the next level is.
Yeah, no, the typical nature of markets from a technical perspective is that they have strong trending impulse moves in a primary trend, and then they backfill and correct the trend, consolidate, get unwind or their overbought state, and then prepare for a resumption in the primary trend. The question and the puzzle to solve here is that how long and how deep does this correction go before that next bull trend resumes? Clearly, each time crude oil has sold off through April, it's made higher lows, which basically means that almost all dips are being bought quite quickly, and the price is holding up very well, especially in a market where, you know, the dollar is ripping and most risk assets are being heavily sold. Oil is being well defended and accumulated. You're absolutely right that, you know, we can talk about that trend line, but I think just clearing those April highs will be really just an advertisement that the next leg has begun, and that could certainly take oil to a fresh new high for the year. And it'll certainly be interesting to see whether we get those breaks in the coming week.
Let's take a look at natural gas futures on page 7. What's going on there? It's interesting that the shape of the chart is so much different from crude oil, considering they're both energy resources.
Well, exactly. And what's interesting is that natural gas just didn't participate at all in the start of the year, at least the North American contract. And then really through March into the first part of April, we saw a doubling in the natural gas prices as we went from $4 to $8. We just had a quick little pullback that saw a quick, you know, 5-day market correction occur. And this is at a really important level in my mind, around the $7.50 level, where we're currently seeing the highs from yesterday. I think that if nat gas can break these levels on the upside, then we could still see another full leg higher. This has been a really strong trend, and it doesn't seem to be quitting. And so while, again, we see a lot of risk assets selling, these energy markets continue to actually take a lot of flow.
Let's take a look at copper futures on page 8. Wow, we really have a pretty significant consolidation that's been lasting almost back for a year now.
Well, this is, I wanted to, because we typically look at the daily charts on copper, and I really wanted to step back and kind of reflect on what happened, because Ole talked about this and his bullishness on the sector and the commodity. And what I was just looking at, well, obviously we had an incredibly bullish run through 2020 and 21 on the upside. And really, we've now spent a year in a sideways consolidation. And maybe it's the fact with a gross slowdown and what's happening in China. Copper right now is clearly stuck in the mud. It failed to hold a 52-week high breakout just a couple of weeks ago. And now we're in a situation where this is going to stay stuck in this range. But, you know, the bigger question here is when does this start to exhibit characteristics of bullishness that is re-resuming its bull trend? And right now, while we certainly can take a lot of bullish stances on a potential breakout in oil and potentially a continuation in nat gas, it really does look on the short term that copper is stuck in the mud here. And it may take the other side of a global slowdown for the next major bull run in copper to really get some traction.
Let's move on to uranium on page 9.
So uranium had a really good bull run through March and April. We saw, this is obviously using that Sprott Physical Uranium Trust unit, and we really got caught in the risk-off cycle here in the last couple of weeks. But what will be really interesting to see is if the characteristic of dips being bought emerges here. And so as this pullback occurs, we've seen in the past that these types of dips would quickly get bought, and we'll want to see whether or not this unit can actually work its way back to like $18, $19 on the upside, and whether uranium can really get some more traction. We're going to be watching to see whether this gets bought on dip. So what I wanted to wrap things up with here, Eric, was just looking at corn. And we could also have put up wheat and soybean. But what is interesting is that when you take a look at the food commodities, they really have not consolidated downwards the way a lot of the industrial metals and other things have been recently hurt. Here we have corn pretty much trading at its 52-week highs and continuing to plug along, and the other grains continue to do well. And we continue to see the inflation pressures on food continue, and certainly this is one of those commodity trends that just remains in play.
Patrick, I think that food is going to be a really big deal in coming years. Unfortunately, I think that we're headed towards global food crises. And the reasons that I predict that are that we've really been in a very, very delicately balanced agricultural economy. We have a huge, huge population explosion problem. Elon Musk telling the world that we need to increase birth rates is about the stupidest thing even Elon has ever said. We have a problem with too many people on the planet and not enough space for everyone, enough ability to make enough food for everyone without the use of modern fertilizers, modern farming equipment, and so forth. As you get into this war situation where a lot of food is produced in Russia and Ukraine, but particularly a lot of potash that's used to make fertilizer is produced there. When you don't have the ability to fertilize crops as readily as we're used to, it means you can't make enough food to feed everybody, and you get to shortages. As I said to Ola Hansen in this week's interview, I'm not talking about the cost of coffee at Starbucks going up. I'm talking about entire small nations being in poverty and famine conditions because of what I think could be coming in the next several years. And we've really got to think carefully about this. And whatever you do, don't listen to Elon Musk. On the other hand, if you'd like someone intelligent to listen to, you can get Patrick's chart decks, not just once a week here on Macro Voices, but every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's service, which you can find out more about on page 11 and 12, or you can just go to bigpicturetrading.com and click on the button to sign up for your free trial. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com. Diversify your portfolio with U.S. farmland, one of the most inflation-protected and recession-resilient asset classes in the world, now available to all accredited investors. And by Composer, making institutional-grade quantitative algorithmic trading and backtesting available to the masses. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Ole Hansen's slide deck, as well as the charts we just discussed here in the post game, as well as a number of links to the articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.